planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Well, Adam, I think our theme music is more on point tonight than it has been at any other time since we started this show.
I guess so. And we are truly living in a golden age, if the man in the high castle has anything to say about it.
You know, somebody's golden age at any rate. Not sure if it's ours or the Nazis, but it is a golden age.
This should be an interesting discussion, because it's one of our choices that was made not so much out of fandom, because neither of us were familiar with the book or the television series before this, but just because it's an interesting subject. This sort of high concept always is.
Well, and anything by Philip K. Dick always makes for interesting entertainment, although I think you have to adapt him in order for it to be entertainment that really clicks with the modern audience. But that's certainly something we're going to talk about. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since we had the idea earlier in the week. I'd watched the first half of the show, but hadn't first half of the first season of the show, but hadn't read the book. And then getting back into everything this week, it's just a lot of fun ideas to discuss.
Yeah, and my wife and I watched the series, which was how we got into this, because I started discussing it with you, and I did finally procure the book from my library, but I'm unfortunately not as far into it as you. You managed to finish it before the show started. I did get far enough through it to see just how much material from the book was borrowed for the show, and that actually surprised me. I have no idea why, but for some reason I assumed that they just took the concept and jettisoned most of the material from the story. That's not actually true.
Well, that tends to be a thing that happens with Philip K. Dick stories. They often get adapted into oblivion, where just the concept survives. But you're right, there's almost all of the really important scenes from the book survive into the show, although often in mutated form.
I'm really curious, after we finish discussing the plot, I'll even let you spoil it for me, because I'm just very curious as to how much the plot for the show hews to the plot for the book. So let's get to it, though, because it's always interesting when you adapt any book into a TV show, and I will say that regardless of how well it executed, the change, I think The Man in the Castle, High Castle, the TV show, has the right ideas about how to change the book.
Yeah, I wanted to start off discussing this whole idea of just how it is that books are adapted into either TVs or movies, because it's something I used to be pretty sensitive to, was this idea of whether or not a piece of entertainment was faithful to the original, and how faithful to the original was it. I used to always want kind of almost a direct one-to-one adaptation. If there's a scene in the book, there should be pretty much the similar scene done the similar way on the screen. And reading, I don't know, I think my experiences the last couple of years, and especially reading this book, I think have changed my mind a little bit.
I would agree with that. This is a lesson I think any Uber fan undergoes at some point, but you realize that they're two different mediums and they have different needs. And sometimes the movies or the television shows are better, with all due apologies to the source material, but I said during Infinity War's discussion that I have a lot more enthusiasm and goodwill toward a number of the Marvel Cinematic Universe iterations of characters than the actual comic book ones. I never really cared much for Iron Man in the Marvel Universe before Robert Downey Jr. took him on.
Well, I think, interestingly enough, it's comic books that have helped to change my perspective on this, because comic books are nothing but an endless series of readaptations of the same story. At least if you're taking, say, Spider-Man from the 1940s, 1950s?
1960s.
So if you take Spider-Man from the 1960s to today, you've gotten various iterations of his origin story. I'm sure you've gotten various iterations of other plot lines, whether it's high school or college, whether it's girlfriends. And it keeps getting recycled by a new generation of writers and artists and storytellers to where it's still Peter Parker, but it's a different take. It's a different perspective. It's a different way of looking at the character. And it's still enjoyable.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think that, relatively speaking, that understanding of how comic book stories work was not as it is today. I think it was, I'd say, not the late 90s, even this century, the continuity was essentially... Or the conceit that this was all one big story, that you were reading Captain America's story and the X-Men story, and that all of these plot lines would eventually be resolved because this was one big epic, was kind of jettisoned in favor of the idea that this is a writer and artist team, and this is their interpretation of the character. And the idea of an interpretation became explicit. Now Mark Waid is going to do Spider-Man's story. Now Grant Morrison is going to do the X-Men's story. And you got this this new understanding, which traditional fans really hated, that you're not really progressing so much as... You know, I mean, it was almost... It wasn't entirely conscious. You know, this is one of those just sort of very subtle changes that developed over time. And nowadays, you know that Peter Parker is not going too far off the grid. He's just going to go back to Seth and go under a new pair of artists and be updated again.
And maybe I benefit by coming to comic books essentially in the last 10 or 15 years. And if this is a fairly recent change in the aesthetic of comic books, it's one I've... it's essentially the only way I've known comic books, but it has helped me understand the importance of adaptations. And I think maybe the other thing that played a role, although I didn't realize it at the time, was in college. I took two classes. Well, I took a lot more than two classes, but two that I'll talk about tonight: Germanic myths, legends, and sagas, and Russian fairy tales. Which Russian fairy tales was just... It was incredibly fun. It was the Russian version of every classic fairy tale that you're used to. Not that the Russians ripped off everything that was happening further west, but I think just different cultures tend to have the same stories that they tell. And so getting the Russian versions of, oh, this is very much like Cinderella, or this is very much like Sleeping Beauty, or this is very much whatever... was just fantastic, and it was a fantastic look into the Russian psyche. But Germanic myths, legends, and sagas was even more explicitly so. It was, okay, let's take Cinderella, but let's compare the old French version to the old German version to the old Norwegian version, and just see how the tale is the same and how it's different between these various cultures. And it really brought home this idea of having a bard or a storyteller that goes around from campfire to campfire or from village to village and telling the story, and different bards come through and they each put their own little twist on the story. And just that's kind of sunk in over the past couple of years as, hey, when you've got a book and you're adapting it for TV or you're adapting it for the big screen, it doesn't have to be exactly the same story. You've got different storytellers, essentially, with the writers and the directors each able to put their own spin on it and bring out different aspects of the characters or different aspects of the events.
Yeah, it's a form of translation. You know, to use biblical criticism terms, you know, you're looking for dynamic equivalents, I think, as opposed to just a direct translation, grammar and all, which is bound to be more difficult and confusing for the reader. It doesn't present, it doesn't result in an effective experience.
Well, and I think there's certain things you can do in different mediums that just do not translate well to other mediums. You know, if you have a story where 90% of it, 90% of the true emotion is the character's inner voice and inner dialogue, you're just going to really struggle to put that on the screen because there isn't really a great way. I mean, even voiceover narration, you can't do voiceover narration for 80% of a movie. You've got to find some way to translate it and make it different and applicable to the medium that it's in. And I think that was something I didn't understand as much when I was in high school, getting annoyed at movies for ruining the source material, is just understanding that idea of translation so that it actually works for the medium that it's in.
One example of what you're talking about that pops into mind, and I don't know if you've ever read of it. I wasn't clever enough to think of it myself, so I'm not suggesting here, or I'm not putting on my writing guru hat or anything. But Watchmen, Alan Moore, in one of his many defenses of the comic against adaptation, you know, says that it's a book about. It's a comic. It's always been a comic, and it works best as a comic. And one of the reasons that critics have said that it's best as a comic as opposed to a film adaptation or now a TV series, I understand there's one in development, is that the view of Dr. Manhattan, you know, there's this overall theme of predestination throughout the work. And this idea that Dr. Manhattan can see all of the timeline at once and he's constantly going back and forth between the future and the past, is that in a comic, unlike in a movie or a television show, and only with more difficulty in a book, in a comic you can easily flip back to an earlier or a later page. So if you ever want to reference what Dr. Manhattan is saying in a particular scene, if he's not responding to the time in which he's physically active, you can actually go back to the page, just like Dr. Manhattan can, and see who he's talking to. And I just think that's really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. Something you can only do in a printed medium that doesn't really work well in a visual medium. I will say, even with this newfound realization and willingness to forgive writers and directors for changes, there are some changes that I would argue are important when you're doing an adaptation, or rather things that you shouldn't change when you're doing as an adaptation. And I'll mention as an example, one of my favorite pet peeves, which is the depiction of Faramir in the Lord of the Rings series, specifically, I believe, in the Return of the King. And just to bring the audience into what I'm thinking about, since not everybody is a Lord of the Rings nerd who's going to remember exactly what I'm talking about, you've got these two brothers, Boromir and Faramir, who are both involved with the One Ring that the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy is about, who both have an opportunity to take the ring for themselves. And Boromir tries to take the ring for himself, ultimately fails, and ultimately, as he's dying, realizes that he did the wrong thing in trying to take it for himself and that he's glad he failed. And then you get some months later, his brother Faramir enters the picture, and Faramir likewise has a chance to take the ring, and Faramir very deliberately turns away from the chance, makes a different decision, and proves himself to be different in moral character, perhaps stronger in moral character than his brother is. And that's all in the book. And in the film, Peter Jackson changed it so that Faramir essentially does exactly what Boromir did, is an exact repeat of his brother in moral character and in direct actions. And I think that kind of change in an adaptation is a bad change. It's changing the essence of who a character is. It's not reinterpreting the story for a different medium. It's not giving your own take on a story, but it's changing something fundamentally different, as though you had a version of Spider-Man where one of Peter Parker's close friends turned out to be the villain, and or maybe you could do that for good storytelling reasons, but if you just do that for no reason whatsoever, to me it just brings a, you don't understand the source material that you're adapting. You don't understand what it is that you're working with. That's my perspective, at least. I'm curious on your thoughts.
Well, I certainly haven't read Lord of the Rings in a while. Did Faramir have a important plot function that Peter Jackson needed fulfilled is my first thought. You know, perhaps, you know, he has to get the characters from point A to point B, and you can either do that with a named character, or else you can have people wondering where is character X for the rest of the movie. I don't know. I'm feeling neutral about it, but I'd certainly take the point.
Well, so let's, rather than belaboring Lord of the Rings specifically, I think that was just a point I wanted to make regarding adaptations, that there are, at least in my opinion, there are good changes and there are not so good changes. But let's dive into the subject at hand, which is specifically The Man in the High Castle. Originally, I suppose when it was published, it would have been considered a novel, about 240 pages. These days, we'd consider it more of a novella, I think. But originally a book by Philip K. Dick, won the Hugo Award when it was published, which is the award given by science fiction fans to the best book of the year, and then has been adapted into a TV show by Amazon. But let's start out talking about the book. You have read some of it at this point, right?
Sure, and I think that even without getting into the plot, you can easily summarize the book. You know, it's a story about when... about an alternate reality in which Nazi Germany and Japan managed to overcome the Allies and then split North America, not perfectly down the middle, but they divvy up the United States. And it's a story about life during those times. The interesting second sci-fi aspect of it is that there is a book... in the novel, there is a book called The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. And in this novel is about an alternate reality in which the Allies won the war. And so you start getting into this metafiction and this fun idea of what is reality anyway. And are in... The novel essentially is placing you in the position of reading a novel in which characters are reading a novel about people in your position. So it's a lot of fun. This window of infinite regress.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like you say, infinite regress. It's almost like looking into a hall of mirrors. And what's interesting is in the novel, The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, that the characters in The Man in the High Castle are reading, the Allies have won the war, but it's not actually our history of how the Allies have won the war. In the novel, within the novel, the war has played out differently. The U.S., I believe, came into the war earlier, while Britain still had more forces remaining, helped Britain roll up the continent a lot faster, ended up wiping out the communists in fairly short order. Chiang Kai-shek wins the Chinese Civil War, and so rather than a communist dictatorship under Mao Zedong, you have a Chinese autocracy under Chiang Kai-shek. And Britain and the U.S. stand alone almost in their own Cold War as two superpowers that have split up the world between themselves and are facing off over who's going to have ultimate say over what form of democracy or what form of capitalism ends up dominating the globe. But it's interesting that way in that it's, yes, the Allies won, but it's not our history. So we know our history. We know the history of the characters of The Man in the High Castle, and then we're also getting this third view of history of the characters in The Grasshopper Lies Heavy.
And I don't think there's any other time to mention it, but I really like the title, The Grasshopper Lies Heavy. It's from a Bible verse, I believe, but it's a bad translation of the Bible verse, which I think is fabulous for a Japanese novel.
For a Japanese novel, and that... that brings up something I noticed as I was reading through the book, is that a lot of the dialogue in the book is, I don't want to say it's a Japanese version of English, but it feels like a lot of the articles have been stripped off. It's English as the way a foreigner might speak it, which just helps to give that sense of looking, you know, into the looking glass, reading something that's not quite our own reality.
So in terms of changes from book to TV show, the central change, I think, is very illustrative of good translation. It makes perfect sense to read a metafictional novel in which the characters are reading a novel, but that's not effective for a TV show. So the first thing I'm sure that the writing team swapped out was that the Grasshopper Lies Heavy is a film, or in fact a sequence of films.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that was the first thing I noticed because I saw the first half of season one of the TV show before I read the novel. So in some ways I did things backwards. But once I started reading the novel, that was the very first thing that jumped out at me is, oh, hey, the characters are all going on and on about this book that everyone has read. And in the Man in the High Castle, everyone is discussing The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, whereas in the TV show, everyone is chasing after these film reels and trying to get their hands on them to see what they are.
Of course, the difference with the film reels is, I assume the book isn't considered to be in any way otherworldly in the novel, right?
Correct. In the novel, the novel was written by a character who lived in Montana, I believe, and had just written it as a work of fiction. And again, interestingly, the meta of all of this is that Philip K. Dick was writing a book of science fiction about an alternate reality, and in his story, there's a character who wrote a book of essentially science fiction about an alternate reality, essentially as a thought experiment of, oh, hey, what if the war had ended differently?
Got it. So the characters in the TV show are faced with a very different object, especially considering that in 1962, modern day production values depicting, you know, a different world were hard to come by. They have films that they can't account for. And this turns the entire story into a very different beast.
Right. It obviously can't be special effects because special effects haven't been invented, at least to anywhere near that degree. And yet here you are, the characters are watching film reels that look exactly like newsreel footage of the war turning out differently. And you're right, it makes it into a very different beast. And I think ultimately the stories are going to end up in different places because there's a limited number of explanations as to how you can have such good looking videos showing a different reality. And I don't think you can pass any of them off as 1960s special effects.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, but I'm fairly sure that by the end of season one, you know, the television series has absolutely made a break from the novel and proceeded down a different route. And that's fine, because of course there's not an infinite amount of material in the novel. It's a great springboard, but then you kind of have to do your own thing.
Right. In the novel, Philip K. Dick's novel, that is really about just what is reality? How do we perceive things? How do we perceive the world around us and our reactions to them? And it really is one 224-page thought experiment of what else, holding up a mirror to our own reality and our own experiences, and how much of what we think we know can we really depend on, and would we act any differently from the way these characters act, which I think is one thing that the novel is about, is how people living under a conquering regime adapt to life under that regime, and whether they are rebellious against it or whether they are accepting of it, which I think is one of the perhaps more minor differences between the book and the TV show, is in the book, a lot of the characters are doing their best to accommodate themselves to life under a Japanese regime. They're trying to act more Japanese. They're trying to learn how to live in Japanese culture and to react the way the Japanese do in their own culture. And they're not really... They're maintaining an American identity, but they're also not, as we might think of it, fighting for truth and independence in the American way.
Yeah, this brings us to the discussion that I'm really interested in having. And for those who are listening, I really feel like it's a discussion you can have even if you don't know anything about the series, except that it's about America under a, you know, a duo Nazi/Japanese regime. Frank Spotnitz, the show's creator, says that one thing that the network made him put in the show was a third side, the resistance, that in addition to this, you know, science fiction-y element, that there was originally no plan to have a bunch of freedom fighters running around trying to throw off oppression, which is interesting both for what it says about, you know, the network, but also what kind of show Spotsitz wanted. He wanted to do that sort of thought experiment where you consider how much being so Spotnitz wanted to do a story about how we are all fish in water when it comes to our ideologies in many ways, that, you know, we think that so many things are beyond the pale, but in fact, you know, Americans would probably get along just fine under a Nazi regime, except for, of course, for all the ones who a Nazi regime is explicitly hostile to. And obviously, this resonates all the more strongly in Trump's America. Not to get too, I'm not going to say that not to get too political. Everything is political. But that is not a show that the network wanted to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the other major differences between the show and the book is the book is pretty much exclusively focused on the Japanese Pacific states. The western half of, or not even the western half, the western third of the U.S. And it takes place entirely under that Japanese dominion. And the Japanese are not necessarily portrayed as the bad guys in the book. They're almost portrayed in a sympathetic light, especially compared to the Nazis. And the Nazis barely figure in the book at all. The U.S. has been conquered, the eastern part of the U.S. and the Midwest have been conquered by Nazi Germany, and that's another power that's, you know, a demilitarized zone away, but none of the action of the book takes place on that side of the fence, so to speak. So the Nazis are always just intruding as someone who's, you know, as you would have diplomatic representatives or perhaps a few military representatives from one country in another country. That's the way the Nazis are portrayed in the Japanese-controlled states. Whereas the TV show, obviously the Nazis are a huge part of the story, and the initial advertising of the show relied heavily on the shock value of seeing a swastika on the U.S. flag or a swastika on the Statue of Liberty or you know, a Nazi flag flying over the White House. And that's a much bigger part of the story. At least 50% of the TV show, I would say, takes place in the Nazi states, the Greater Reich, rather than in the Japanese states.
Yeah, I noticed that in the show, and I think there's an interesting sort of... racist might even be the right word for it, but it's too strong a word maybe for what I want to talk about, that the Japanese are kind of looked on more kindly in the book and the show, even though in truth they were absolutely as racist and heedless of the destruction they caused. But the Nazis are supposed to be the grand evil, and not only that, but they give white people a lot more to do.
Right, and it is interesting to just keep in mind that from a historical perspective, I think it's forgotten about, perhaps, or at least put so far on the back burner that it might as well have been forgotten about, that the Japanese were just as racist as the Nazis were. Just as the Nazis held up the Aryan ideal, the Japanese had their own version of the Aryan ideal, and they didn't necessarily, I don't think, want to go as far as complete extermination the way the Nazis did, but that was more of a difference in degree rather than a difference in kind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert on it. I think it was more an issue of exterminating people whenever they were inconvenient, as opposed to on the matter of principle, as I think the Nazis tended to do. You know what? The term I was looking for was probably Eurocentric, as opposed to racist. I think that works nicely, because of course, being Americans, we're much more interested in European history in general.
As evidenced by the fact that I'm struggling to remember exactly what it was that the Japanese regime did have as its goals and its aims. And that's only because it didn't affect us as directly as it affected the Chinese and the Koreans and, shall we say, the non-Euro-centric peoples of the world.
Okay, so bringing this back around, though. So Spotnitz wanted to make The Man in the High Castle a show about just how easily people can accommodate evil ideas, that, you know, our souls do not rebel as much as we like to think they do, or imagine they would. And, in fact, I had in my drawer a story of my own, just a synopsis, you know, a light sketch of ideas, and I was going to call my story The Good Man. And just essentially have a story about a guy who is absolutely fantastic and personable and who you're really rooting for, but he happens to be doing all of this in 1930s Germany, and he's a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party. And because I always thought, like Frank Spotnitz, I imagine, that this was interesting, that you could be a fish swimming in vile water and have all these good qualities that we consider good, but be part of this larger, absolutely evil machine. And the reason that I would not want to write that story anymore is probably the reason that the network didn't want to write it, which is that at the time I was considering it, I thought to myself that Nazism, you know, was essentially a historical evil. And that war essentially had been won. But in a time in which the right wing is resurgent, having perfectly nice Nazis running around is actually potentially irresponsible.
Right. It's propagandistic almost at this time rather than a historical discussion.
Exactly. And so that's what I see here. And it's that, you know, the Man in the High Castle has kind of been formed and maybe reformed in the offices of the network into a story about resistance against a clearly evil force that all the main characters realize is wrong. Which is a departure from the material, but perhaps a violation of the central spirit of the novel. And yet, for all that, probably the right choice right now?
Yeah, I think I would agree. And this comes back to what I said just a little bit ago about permissible changes versus impermissible changes when you're doing adaptations versus what's just a difference in perspective. And I do think this is a very interesting point to consider, because the novel feels very different than the TV show does, and that the novel is about characters who are accommodating themselves to the world that they live in, whereas the TV show is more about characters who are struggling back against the world that they live in. And it's a fundamental change, and it's one that, interestingly, doesn't bother me. I feel like it's something that normally would, or not that long ago would have bothered me. But it feels like, and maybe it's what you're saying, that it's just the time that we live in. It feels like the right choice to translate it this way. But again, maybe it goes also back to what I mentioned about internal dialogues versus external events. The book is very much about people's internal feelings as they're accommodating themselves to the regime. We're getting into their heads. We're seeing their motivations. We're seeing their regrets, their fears, their uncertainties, their anxieties. And it's really almost a character study of what it is to go through this kind of world. Whereas that's something that does not translate to the screen. I don't think you could do the book as written without it being a much, much different show, a much almost slower show, a more, as it were, literary show, which might be interesting, but it would be far less popular, I think.
Almost Mad Men-esque or something, at least of that genre, right?
Right, exactly. You would see characters going through their normal day-to-day life, doing day-to-day things, and there wouldn't be much action or intrigue or conspiracies. In a sense, there wouldn't be much happening.
Okay, and so this brings me, I mean, I think you've described it perfectly. I'm just going to make explicit your point. So the changes in the show that seem like, you know, we can understand why they had to be made, has resulted not only in the central object of the show changing because of the medium, and not only the, you know, the central conflict of the show changing because of the time we live in, but also the genre of the show changing because it's not a character piece, it's a thriller.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. The show is, the show's not action, it's not as far as action, but it is a thriller, whereas the book is a character piece. It's the difference between literature and a more mainstream novel that is sitting on the shelves in an airport.
I feel like it could have been written by, say, Ken Follett.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just find that fascinating that, you know, in The Jump, for perfectly legitimate and clear reasons, that The Man in the High Castle, the book, has changed so drastically into the television show that it is. I just think that's, everything undergoes, in general, this sort of transformation, but it's very clear here.
I'll give one example. I don't know if you've gotten to this in the book or not. One character that's different between the book and the TV show, and in a way that I think illustrates perfectly the transformation that the story went through as it was adapted. In the book, you've got Robert Childen, who owns an antique shop in San Francisco, primarily selling Americana to the Japanese. The Japanese are presented as just being nuts for anything pre-war American, whether that's Civil War, whether that's 1920s, whether that's founding era, and just all kinds of stuff. Stamps, comic books, clothing, weapons, just anything that's American from an earlier period. And Robert Childen owns this store, and in the book, he tries very hard, believes that he is selling authentic merchandise to the Japanese, very much wants to find the perfect pieces for them, wants to be respected by them, takes his job very seriously, basically, and it tries to be as Japanese as he can, and sincerely so, not just as a mask. And finds out that a revolver that he sold to a Japanese couple is a fake, and is horrified by the thought that it's a fake, and goes after his supplier, Hammer and Tongs, to find out how it was that he got a fake, and wanting to make sure that that never, ever happens again. Then you get to the TV show. Got the same character, Robert Childen. He's running an Americana antique store. But in the show, he is not trying to be Japanese. He's selling them stuff. He's taking their money. But he's very much got an independent attitude and runs across the same revolver that turns out to be a fake, exactly like the book. But in this case, he's contemptuous of the Japanese. He's not horrified that he sold them a fake. He's contemptuous that they didn't realize it was a fake. And he decides, hey, let's see if we can find other fakes to sell them and rip them off, because they're idiots who don't know what it is that they're buying, so we can take them for all that they've got. And there's even an identical scene between the book and the TV show in which he's talking about, here's two cigarette lighters, one of which was in Roosevelt's pocket when he was assassinated, one of which, you know, was just picked up off the street yesterday. To the naked eye, they're completely indistinguishable. What makes one worth $50,000 and the other worth five is just the sense of history that's around it. And again, in the book, that's presented as something, that sense of historicity is presented as something to take seriously and to value, whereas in the show it's presented as it's meaningless and it's just a way, if someone values it too much, it's just a way that you can rip them off and get their money for yourself, so that you can either enrich yourself at their expense or you can fund the resistance, whatever. But it's just interesting. That happens multiple times as I was reading through the book. I was seeing things that are like, okay, same character, same story elements, but with a completely 180 spin on the perspective and on the meaning.
I'm going to stick an asterisk on what you've just said, because as I recall, Harry Children, is that the name?
Maybe Harry in the show, definitely Robert in the book.
Okay. But he says, but he starts off in the show as very much the character that you're describing. And he becomes contemptuous of the Japanese and Togami, when he essentially realizes that when he gets his hopes up, that they're finally going to take him as a person cultured like themselves. And then he realizes that that's never going to be the case, that he's white, he's a gaijin, and that's all he'll ever be. So there's this sort of disillusionment, and then you have this different character, the results, that's probably a lot more useful for plot purposes. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think as far as the show goes, that's essentially correct. Whereas in the book, same events happen, and you know, the turn is around a dinner party where he's with a Japanese couple and realizes how much they view him as an outsider. And in the show, you're right, that completely turns him to being contemptuous of everything and being more of a rebeller or part of the rebellion, or at least just having internal resistance to the culture. Whereas in the book, it, if anything, prompts him to rededicate himself to fitting in with the culture and realizing that he is not as far along as he thought he was in adapting to Japanese norms and customs.
I find that character striking and perhaps even a little painful. I think that, I guess it's a universal experience, but the desire to fit in, if you will. But the idea of a guy who's trying to fit in and knows a lot of words in an East Asian language and the like, but isn't really capable of making it all the way, or at least hasn't reached that point yet. I mean, I think that's
almost autobiographical, would you say?
It certainly resonates pretty strongly, and I think it would with a lot of people, especially if they actually, you know, made a life in Korea or Japan or China, because you aren't ever going to bridge that gap any more than, unfortunately, many minorities and the like do in America. That's interesting. I like the, I think it's poignant, and I really like that character.
So I don't know how deep we want to go into differences between the show and the book. I think it's, I almost feel like we've said our piece. There are differences, and it is differences that turn it from a character study into a thriller, which works better for the medium that it's in. And I'm almost at this point.
This is like our first non-spoilery review, or it could have been.
It could have been. I almost don't feel like there's a lot to spoil in the book, because in some senses, not much happens in the book. I guess, spoiler, the main female character ends up meeting the man in the high castle, and the meeting is somewhat anticlimactic. And again, it's just more of a character study and how people view the world around them. And then the novel ends. There's not really any real events in the story to spoil.
Okay. Well, actually, you have raised one event, and I want to mention this. I was disappointed. I don't know if this is a spoiler, but it's within the first, I think the very first episode of season two, you find this out, but, there is a person, known as the man in the high castle who a character meets. But at the end of season one of the man in the high castle, you're left with a very strong impression that the man in the high castle is Hitler. And I thought that was a fantastic swerve because, you know, he's an established character. You see him, but he's not on your list of suspects. You know, you don't really have a list of suspects. It's not like any of the other characters could qualify. So, you know, you assume that there's a revelation coming, or, you know, you'll find out. But when it turns out to be not just a reveal, but a revelation, that's cool. So I really liked how the first season ended there, as you slowly realize, or you so slowly see those pieces get put in place. You know, he's driving up the road, up this mountain, up to this castle, into this room where where a man who was historically well known for loving films is standing.
You know, now that you've talked about all that, I absolutely see it. And yet when I was watching episode 10, it completely sailed over my head 150%. I didn't realize there was even anything in motion. I think partly because I'd read the novel and had this very definite sense that the man in the high castle was a dude in Wyoming who was doing stuff. And I had that so firmly fixed in my head that I've been expecting the TV show to have its own version of a dude in Wyoming who's collecting films for whatever reason. And the setup of Hitler being a dude who's trying as hard as he can to collect each of these films as they show up, who it turns out lives in a castle that is atop a very high mountain. And in fact, the castle itself is inside of two different curtain walls, each higher than the last. You're right, the visual evidence of this being a man in a very high castle is indisputable, and yet I'm just amazed it sailed completely past me because of my own preconceptions.
Well, you know what? You're not wrong, because I assure you, season two begins with you learning that there's a man who he's maybe from Wyoming, I don't know, but I think the idea that Adolf Hitler was the man in the high castle is essentially dispensed with pretty quickly, but which was a big letdown for me. Like, season two did not start well for me, in part because I thought that they had clearly given me an answer to a question and had nothing better in its place when they told me I was mistaken.
I will say Hitler himself is an interesting example of changes between the book and the TV show, where ironically, if anything, the TV show, at least in season one, has treated him more respectfully than the book did. In the book, Hitler is still alive, but is basically an insane syphilitic that the Nazi party keeps out of public view and out of power and influence in Germany. At least I think he's still alive. He might have actually died a couple of years earlier. He's certainly not the Reichschancellor anymore. That's gone to someone, Bormann, I believe. Yeah, Martin Bormann is Chancellor of Germany in the book, who was one of Hitler's chief aides in real life. So yeah, in the book, he's an insane syphilitic because of the relationships he had much earlier in his life, again, historically documented. And he's a character almost of ridicule in the time period of the book, whereas in the TV show, he's still alive. He's portrayed as being not in great health, but he is still in, he is still Reich's Chancellor, and he is still in control, which is, like I say, a more respectful view of Hitler.
A respectful view of Hitler. Well, there you have the episode title for this latest. Definitely get some curiosity clicks with that one. You know, one thing that surprised me about the last episode in which Adolf Hitler appears is that he does appear and that he does become a character. There's force in that, of course, because again, it's Adolf Hitler. But I think if the movie were made 20 years ago, you would never have done this. You know, Adolf Hitler is treated almost like is one of those characters like Moses or Jesus that you don't really put other people's words in.
Right. And I thought that was the direction they were going in the TV show, because for the first 2 or 3 minutes of screen time, he's seen only in silhouette, only from the background, only as a voice speaking from the other side of a room. And then in fact, when he does get up and walk towards the other character who's in the room with him, the camera focuses in on the back of the other man's head, such that Hitler himself is still blurred out of view. And initially I thought this was going to be a deliberate choice. I mean, my thought was, what actor wants to be known for having been Adolf Hitler? And I know there have been a lot of different shows about Hitler in Germany where different people have played Hitler. But at the same time, you know, I don't know that that's something I want on my acting resume. Makes a pretty good Hitler. Not my first thought.
Right, but the character, or rather the historical figure, has just generally been considered too weighty for that sort of deployment. You know, especially in a sci-fi thriller movie.
Right.
But the Man of the High Castle goes all in. I don't feel this is a spoiler at all, but you get someone portraying Himmler in season 2, and the preview for season 3 has a walking, talking Josef Mengele. Is that how you pronounce his name?
We'll say it is.
Anyway, which is really kind of shocking if you think about it, and brings up a question I had as I was just jumping on real quick and Googling around, which is, why is this show not more controversial? HBO wanted to do a show called The Confederates a little while back by the writers of Game of Thrones, in which, you know, the Confederacy successfully defended itself, and so slavery remains as a modern institution. And the backlash was so strong that, although they have not canceled the show, or at least have not explicitly canceled it, it's pretty clearly dead. Nobody has talked about it since. And for another example, last year, Marvel Comics, the year before maybe, Marvel Comics had a big crossover in which the central idea was that Captain America was turned into a Nazi by the power of a cosmic cube. And again, everyone flipped out about it. But the Man in the High Castle seems to get a complete pass.
I almost wonder, and I'm looking this up as I'm talking, so we'll see if I come up with an answer. I'm almost wondering if it's just a matter of Nazi Germany is not our history, whereas the American Civil War is. The American Civil War is in some ways an active sore point and maybe an active wound for a lot of Americans. It's something, it's a period, or at least the racist South is a period that we're still sensitive to and embarrassed by. And so the idea of making a TV show about that is, or where that continued, is for Americans a little bit horrifying in a way that's maybe special to us. Whereas I can imagine The Man in the High Castle being more controversial in Germany, especially given that the German government has for a very long time now made Nazism illegal. Nazi paraphernalia, Nazi symbology, Nazi phrases. Germany has very strong laws against all of that kind of stuff, and I have to imagine this is a show that would be a lot more controversial in Germany than it would be in the U.S.
That's a good explanation. I don't know if it's true, but I buy it. I think, yeah, not only that, but I guess the Nazis have become sort of this blank slate, if you will. I mean, we all understand the basic tenets of Nazi ideology, which is to say, get rid of people who aren't white and preferably blonde and blue-eyed. But at the same time, they're no longer treated like real people. They're the stormtroopers, which is a Nazi term. they're the historical stand-ins for the Empire in Star Wars, just as the Empire is the stand-in for that sort of evil empire in fiction.
Yeah.
Which is, perhaps that was confusing, but, you know, Nazis tend to be desperately boring unless you really humanize them at this point. You know, they've been emptied of their meaning. Which is probably one of the big mistakes that we as a culture have kind of made of them, and part of the reason why the right wing has experienced something of a comeback, because it's very easy to say you're not a Nazi when Nazis are cartoons now. For example, one interesting thing that Hannah Arendt wrote, I think it was Hannah Arendt who I read, was about the debilitating level of stupidity in Nazi Germany. That is, Adolf Hitler told these amazing, stupid lies, but it also took a people to believe them. That, you know, you couldn't reason these people, that they were very much Trumper-like in their, you know, in how they were, what they really had at the root was a level of resentment that was just all-encompassing.
Yeah, and I think that's going to go down some avenues that would be an interesting discussion, but one that I'm not sure I want to have tonight. I think I'll just say, I think maybe part of the reason the Nazis have become boring is because the Nazis were as evil as they were. I've read a few books that are historical about Nazi Germany and about the kinds of things that went on in Nazi Germany in terms of concentration camps, in terms of experiments carried out upon prisoners. And it was horrifying. It was really, truly, deeply, it affected me emotionally how horrifying Nazi treatment of other human beings was. And it took me a number of weeks to, in a sense, flush that strong emotional reaction out of my system. And it's still not something I like to go back and think about. And there may be an element to the Nazis were so horrifying that you don't want to think about how horrifying the Nazis were. And so you kind of paper over it in your memory and it becomes more of a blank slate that you say, sure, the Nazis were evil, but you don't actually think about it in depth.
Yeah, and beyond that, I think it's an issue of tone. You know, any real story grappling with Nazis as they were is going to be desperately dark. And even a number of war movies don't want to be that dark. You know, I mean, you have different levels of war movie. You have war movies that would be enjoyable popcorn flicks, and you have those that you go to see, like Black Hawk Down, when you want to experience the visceral tragedy of armed conflict. And you adjust the depiction and you edit the Nazis, if you will. Edit the Nazis is perfectly correct, and to get the feel that you want.
Yeah, I think I agree. It's putting the Nazis as they actually were on screen in a movie would be, I don't think, a movie that would draw much of an audience, honestly, or would draw entirely the wrong kind of audience. And so we tend to get a sanitized view of the Nazis when we get a view of the Nazis.
So you may be right. Maybe I've bogged us down a little bit here. There was one other thing that I wanted to discuss, because I think this was how we originally got on the subject of doing The Men in the High Castle for a podcast. But we wanted to talk about the world building and why we didn't quite buy it.
And I think when we start with the world building, I start with the world building of the book a little bit, because the Nazi Reich and the history of the last 20 years is mentioned in the book, and a lot of that is repeated in season one of the TV show, so you can consider it canon both ways, I guess, which is that the Nazis went full-on German efficiency after they won World War II. They completed the extermination of the Semites, the Jews, from Europe, and then they got to work on the extermination of everyone non-Aryan in Africa, which is, you know, almost everyone in Africa. And the book at least says that they almost got that completed, and it's, I think, implied, if not outright stated, that everyone who wasn't killed was turned into slaves again. So we re-brought slavery into the picture as an institution. And that kind of the world building, I think, is reasonable. I think you can extrapolate that had the Nazis won World War II, that's roughly what would have happened, or at least very likely to have been what happened. And then the book takes a right turn into more fabulous events. Apparently, the Nazis drained the Mediterranean Sea and turned the basin into farmland, which, I'm not quite sure how you drain an entire sea of that size. I'm not sure where you put all of the water as you're draining it. I'm not sure what kind of a public works project that is, but that just seems like a massive undertaking to just casually throw out, oh yeah, they drained the Mediterranean and turned it into farmland. And then in the book, the Nazis have not only drained the Mediterranean, they've also started a colonization project for the solar system. So, using German rocketry knowledge and an advanced knowledge of plastics, interestingly enough, because it's basically stated that their spaceships are made of advanced plastic composites. And again, when you're doing atmospheric reentry, I'm not sure how well plastics actually stand up.
Wow.
But they've colonized the moon and Venus, Mercury, and are working on Mars.
Dick had a very high opinion of the Nazis in some ways.
Or a very good relationship with his drug dealer. that was the part where the book almost seemed like he'd been maybe a little bit high as he was writing it, gotten carried away with his vision. But yeah, if I remember correctly, the solar system colonization isn't a thing at all in the TV show, but the conquest of Africa and the extermination in Europe certainly is, and I think I even heard a reference to draining the Mediterranean.
I think at least a few of the ideas that you've mentioned are whittled down to mentions in a more sane form in season two of the television show, that they want to build some sort of massive hydroelectric dam or something of the sort, perhaps. Or irrigation system in Africa. I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, the point is that it's going to cause a whole lot of ecological damage. But hey, progress. But, you know, nothing quite so insane as the draining of the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I would agree. That would be a more sane alternative. But that brings us to the part of the world building that I think is more what we wanted to focus on, which is in the book, the United States lost the war, but the United States, at least as far as I can determine, because again, the Nazis are barely peripheral characters in the book, but as far as I can determine, the United States still exists as a country. It's just a country that follows Nazi law and that exists as a client state of the Reich. but is not itself directly part of the Reich. You've still got a president, you've still got Congress, you've still got all of the institutions that Americans are familiar with. It's just that being a Jew is illegal, and physical defects are not looked kindly upon, and that sort of thing. Whereas in the TV show, we've actually got the greater Nazi Reich that has extended into America, and we've actually gotten this complete Nazi structure in what used to be the United States. I mean, one of our main characters is Obergruppe Führer Smith, who walks around in full SS black uniform and has superiors and inferiors and the whole works. And America has been absorbed into the Reich. And I think that's the part where you and I both said, this doesn't quite feel real.
Yeah. Why is he going around being called by a German word? Why, you know, why? That's exactly right. It's not a plausible scenario, which it doesn't have to be for the type of show it is. I think in the original version of the story that Frank Spotnitz wanted to make, it would have been wiser to go the route of the plausible, that the U.S. is a client state. And it's interesting to hear that in that respect, the book is far more reasonable. But I suppose for a thriller in which you're resisting the evil Nazis, that's fine. You know, if you stretch your brain hard, I guess you could come up with the idea that knowing German well is kind of a status symbol, much like knowing French in the 19th century in Russia and the sort. So, you know, anyone who really wants to climb the ladder or really wants social standing learns German as well as they can. That said, it's still, it's not subtle.
Yeah, it's not subtle, and I think it was one of the things that drew me out of the show right in the first episode. You know, my initial thought is Americans would never cotton to that kind of a structure. They would never cotton to that direct Nazi involvement and Nazification of America. And you know, seeing how many Americans are okay with the more vile things that Trump says, or at least don't protest against them at all, and learning recently that there were, in fact, large Nazi rallies in the 1920s in New York City, tells me that there would be maybe more of an acceptance of Nazism than I would like to believe. But I still think Americans are fundamentally ornery, and just losing a war wouldn't cause us to be okay with throwing over all of the established governmental institutions. I still think the book is more realistic in its depiction of a U.S. with the same government but being a client state under the Reich than the TV show is, with portraying basically we've swapped one government for another with a completely different structure.
Another thought occurs to me. And this, I guess, is an anti-spoiler, because now you know that it has not happened in the second season, but that I would find it, and I think it would be a nice touch if it did. You know, history is full of anecdotes in our in our family about, or at least, you know, I have a lot of German blood in me, and my understanding is that when World War I occurred, that a huge segment of the American population, the German immigrants who came over in the 19th century, essentially abruptly stopped speaking German in order to not be accused of disloyalty in the time of war fever. And that this resulted in us being assimilated to such a degree that, you know, obviously we more or less lack any sort of individual culture now. We're more or less fully subsumed within the Anglo-Saxon based culture of white America. And it would be interesting for some of the Nazi characters in The Man in the High Castle to talk about how, you know, the tragic time of their people when Germans were so discriminated against, but fortunately the Nazis have liberated them and now they can claim their, you know, rightful mantle on top.
Well, that would bring up another question of, did all of the Germans, or did a large percentage of the Germans who changed their names to less German-sounding names, who stopped speaking German, how much prior to that they still thought of themselves as Germans versus Americans with a slightly different culture? You know, is it that they felt the need to throw off everything German out of fear of the people around them? Or was it that they kind of said, in an affirmative sense, no, we're not with them. We are different. We are Americans. As a statement of identity rather than as a statement out of fear, if you understand where I'm coming from with that. Yeah, I guess I'll just give you a moment to respond. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think you are. And I'm sure there's some of that. I remember reading somewhere that in general, the third generation of a family that's immigrated is the one that essentially transforms and really becomes American. So, you know, they were always going to do that in all likelihood. But at the same time, my understanding is that, you know, there are plenty of towns and communities in which German was the lingua franca, and that that's what you heard everywhere, you know, much like Spanish today and so forth. And so I assume that it just got a real thrust, a real accelerated pace.
Yeah, I would definitely think that's definitely part of the case. So yeah, I think that's the biggest thing about the world of the TV show that bugs me, is I understand why they're doing it, having characters in the U.S. that are more Nazi brings home the world of the show visually in a way that other depictions wouldn't. But if I'm going to pick one piece of the world building that feels off and makes the show not click as well for me as it could, I think that's it. Anything else on the world building that we wanted to mention? I think when we were talking earlier, the Nazis were the only thing that was really coming up. But now that we've both seen more of the show, anything else you want to bring up?
Yeah, I think that'll do. It's interesting that the Japanese are 20 years behind in developing the atom bomb, I guess. But no, on the whole, I'm satisfied. I think we covered most of it for me.
Yeah, I think the... I guess it's hard to say what would have happened in our own timeline that we're living in, because we so thoroughly dominated Japan after we won the war, that I'm not quite sure what they would have had they been left to themselves and had their own chance to develop. But I do think, at least as I understand things, a huge amount of the scientists on the Manhattan Project were German physicists, German Jewish physicists in a lot of cases.
Sure, that makes sense.
So I think it would have been natural for the Nazis to have at least a multi-year lead.
Yeah, I do too. The Japanese were, even back then, no slouch in the engineering department, though. I think, you know, they, both the Japanese and the Germans have a well-deserved reputation for technology and efficiency. Anyway, but no, I think that about does it for me. We have a little note here about the sort of tortured release history, because the wheels came off production a little bit during season two, with the showrunner, Frank Spotnitz, actually leaving. And instead of appointing another showrunner, Amazon just saying, carry on, and then putting out the rest of the season. And that appears to be something they're changing, but... A lot of people consider season two to be a very inferior installment of the series, and season three has taken much longer than it was supposed to come down the pike.
Yeah, that's what I found interesting as I was looking into this, is at least based on a couple of tweets from last year, it looked like Series 2 started filming last June, so we're almost at the 12-month mark, and we've gotten a teaser trailer that was released about seven months ago at New York Comic Con, but we haven't had any kind of an official release date from Amazon as to when it's coming or what the status of Season 3 is. I've got to think we're going to get a Season 3 because we've got the teaser trailer and they've sunk a fair bit of money into it. But it is a bit interesting that we don't have a release date yet. It looks like a show that had a rough patch in Season 2 and maybe hasn't fully pulled out of that yet.
Yeah, and it still can. The Walking Dead kind of nosedived for a season before it managed to right itself after Frank Darabont left. Obviously it's not a good thing. Here's what I just wonder as a writer who's never had an opportunity to go inside the production facilities of a television show. What does it mean when the showrunner leaves halfway through a season, considering that every episode of a season gets streamed at the same time?
I think it depends on how the show is actually being produced and whether episodes are being kind of created in a sequence one after another, that is, being story and plotting and details, or whether Frank Spotnitz had sat down with all of the writers and kind of planned out the entirety of Season 2 right at the very beginning, and then was he just an overall coordinator and project manager getting everything produced according to schedule? Because I can well imagine that a show like this might have been initially plotted and structured and planned out, and then if he leaves in the middle of the season, well, we've still got a plan that we can execute the rest of, maybe not quite as smoothly as we originally would have, but different from if you're suddenly got a different group of people trying to decide, wait, now what's supposed to happen in episode 6? We've got to plan out episode 6.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, surely they'd have to, especially in today's world and with series like this, in which, you know, we expect a series to be one storyline. You have to start out by plotting it all. In television shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that are a little more episodic, I think you may have less of that. The general wisdom, I remember at least Alan Sepinwall saying that you needed to wait about 7 episodes before you started to see a production team start to respond to what they were seeing appear on television. That, you know, they can't tell what's working and what's not until it comes out. And that's after about 7 episodes have had a chance to air. So in the case of streaming, of course, I would think that means that you are SOL if you don't get it right the first time. And that, you know, if you don't like the show in episode 6, then good luck in season 2, because we made them all at once.
You could get a tone adjustment between season 1 and season 2, and I think I've certainly noticed that watching more recent shows versus older shows. As older shows, you could definitely see an evolution from the beginning of season 1 to the end of season 1, and you could see characters becoming more fully formed. Not just that you learned more about them, but that they actually evolved and you know, went from being an amorphous blob to an actual thing as both the actor and the writers figured out who it was that this character was. Whereas more modern shows seem to have more of the same tone and the feel from the beginning of a first season to the end of a first season. And then if you're going to see an adjustment, you're going to see an adjustment between season 1 and season 2.
I guess the more I think about it, if you can get away with it, wouldn't you want to film, you know, every scene in one location throughout a series or throughout one season at the same time, and then, you know, for maximum efficiency, move over to the next set and then do all of the scenes in that set throughout the show? But of course, the obvious problem with that is that it would just be heck on the actors, that nobody would be feeling the story as it develops. But then when I think about that objection, I think to myself, yes, but hasn't CGI essentially done the same thing to them? Doesn't the modern actor have to live inside his or her own imagination?
Yeah, and that's certainly something that it would be fun to have a conversation about later, is just how acting itself has changed over the years from acting on a fully fleshed out set to acting in front of a green screen, where sometimes your co-stars aren't even on the set with you, and yet you're having to give a full and complete emotional performance. I would think just the craft of acting is dramatically different from what it used to be. But like I say, conversation for another time. Yeah, I think season three, you know, I don't know if they actually started filming last June, or maybe they just started some preliminary filming, bringing in a new show writer, new relationship, or new showrunner, sorry, new relationship with writers, figuring out where it is you want season three to go. And perhaps even, you know, if Frank Spotnitz had a very definite view of what he wanted the show to be as a character study, and then you bring in a new showrunner who possibly has his own ideas, very probably has his own ideas of what the series can be, I suppose it makes sense you might have a longer production period, just figuring out how it's evolving from season two to season three.
Yeah, well, Anna and I are going to watch it, I'm pretty sure, but don't get me wrong, it's not a great show. You know, I think it's fairly entertaining, but this is not a masterpiece. It's one of those, I like how the plot hangs together. You know, usually everything ties in fairly well, and you see where they were going. And beyond that, I do enjoy shows that are not so absolutely cocky, foolishly or otherwise, that they don't attempt to tell an arc in one season. For me, The Man in the High Castle rides that line really well. There are outstanding questions, or in any way, you can definitely see how the plot can develop further after a season. I don't feel like everything has been closed off after the first season. But at the same time, you know, you've had a story told. And I appreciate that. I don't see it so much. Better Call Saul is an absolutely wonderful show, but the, confidence is almost offensive by the time you get to the third season, when you can follow a character around for something like 15 minutes without any dialogue. It's wonderful, and that show's production team is well within its rights because, you know, they aren't that good. But thank goodness other shows don't try it.
Yeah, if every show tried to do that, it would just be, as you say, obnoxious. No, I think my own verdict on Man in the High Castle, I enjoyed season one. I have a bit of trepidation hearing your rather lukewarm review of season two, and yet I enjoyed the end of season one enough that I'm looking forward to going into season two and watching more of it, and I'm kind of glad that I am behind on the show such that I can just immediately start season two rather than having to go through a delayed period of waiting. And of course then I'll finish season two and have to join the rest of the world in waiting for season three. But I think we've pretty thoroughly covered Man in the High Castle.
And without really getting into the plot.
So, readers, if you're intrigued by this whole conversation, pick up the book, watch the TV show, one or the other or both. I think it's not a waste of your time. But moving on from Man in the High Castle, we'll move to another troubled production, a movie that will be out in about 2 weeks. That we're both going to be seeing, well, by the time this episode releases, in about a week and a half, Solo, A Star Wars Story. And it's one I've kind of been looking forward to. Han Solo's one of the characters I like more than others in the Star Wars universe. But it's one, as we've been talking online, you're very definitely not looking forward to. Not, I would say, anticipating the pleasure of watching. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Let's not talk about that a little bit. No, I'm sorry. I'm speaking of the movie, not the suggestion that we talk about it. Anna is much less curmudgeonly than me, so we're definitely going to see it. Plus, of course, we have MoviePass. But Disney's Star Wars films are sitting at about, batting 333 right now for me. The Force Awakens was entertaining, but I never want to watch it again because it is what it is. Of course, everyone knows what it is. Rogue One was not a good movie. Neither of us thought it was. And of course, The Last Jedi was great, but it's received massive blowback. And I wonder if Disney is going to back off that approach in the future. Hopefully not.
Yeah, I was thinking recently that it says something and not necessarily something great. That the Star Wars movie recently that you and I like the most is the Star Wars movie that has received the most criticism. And the movie that we liked the least, well, I think I maybe have a stronger dislike for The Force Awakens than you do, but neither one of us really liked The Force Awakens or Rogue One, and both of those movies seemed well received by Star Wars fandom. So I think it is fair to question has Star Wars fandom passed us by? Are we shockingly out of the mainstream? And apparently we are.
Exactly. Whether we're right or wrong, what you can say is that Star Wars films are not being made with us in mind, it seems. Beyond that, you've mentioned it. There's extensive reshoots going on. That's never a good sign. It doesn't automatically doom a film, but I can't remember a film that underwent extensive reshooting recently that turned out to be something I really enjoyed. Can you?
No, I'm not sure that I can. Solo was originally being directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and at the point they were fired, the story I'd heard was that they were going for a more comedic tone, a Guardians of the Galaxy vibe. And I actually had a positive feeling about them being fired, because I've never thought of Han Solo's backstory as being the stuff that comedies are made out of, that feel-good, fun movies are made out of.
I'm really glad they did change that direction, so maybe that at least is a good sign.
It's like if that was the vibe they were going for, and depending how much of it they'd shot before they were fired... this may be one of the few cases where a reshoot actually saves a movie rather than sinking it. I guess it depends on how well the final production hangs together and how much of the seams you can see between the original shots and the new shots. But I at least am somewhat optimistic that they're going for the right tone in the movie, whether or not they pull it off.
Sure. Okay. To continue without... bogging down too much. I'll say it. I'm over the characters. At the end of the day, Star Wars concepts are just not as infinitely interesting as their biggest fans would have you believe. Every face in the theater smiled, including mine, when Harrison Ford came on screen in The Force Awakens. There is just that much goodwill for him, but I don't feel the need to answer a lot of these questions that fandom is interested in, and which you are going actually to talk about in a minute, I believe. And I guess maybe that's just the tradesman in me, the writer, coming through a bit. You start the story at the latest point you can, and the stuff which isn't important tends not to get mentioned. And a lot of this, whatever the prequels have in it, are by definition stuff that we didn't need to see. Which brings me to my last point, which is that I just find prequels less inherently interesting than sequels. That doesn't mean they can't be fantastic. Once again, shout out to Better Call Saul, which in many ways is superior to Breaking Bad. But there's certainly less material because you've already closed off a number of possibilities.
Yeah, that's certainly true. When you're doing a prequel, there are stories you can't tell simply because you've got stories that you need to be aligned with. Although, and this only proves your point, George Lucas, when he shot the prequels to Star Wars, did a lot to completely run roughshod over his original chronology and his original setup, which you'd like to think was done in the interest of making a better story because it was hard to sync up. But in fact, the prequels were just dreadful in general. So I think we just have to lay that at the feet of George not being nearly as good of a writer as he'd like to think it is. But anyway, mm-hmm. that doesn't change your point that prequels are more constrained than a later story would be.
Sure. That said, you know, it does have some strengths going for it, like all of America. And I don't know when exactly this happened, but at some point we all developed a lot of goodwill for Donald Glover.
And I've done my best to avoid trailers and to avoid previews and to avoid teasers. But the little bit I have been unable to avoid seeing of Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian does look absolutely fantastic. And Lando was a character I feel like I always wanted to see a little bit more of in the Star Wars universe, just because he was a character that didn't have a lot of screen time to begin with. So if all we get is a good view of Lando Calrissian, I think I'll be entertained by this movie.
Other people disagree, but I think Alden Ehrenreich looks decently like a Han Solo. I feel like going into the movie, I won't be constantly saying he's not Harrison Ford.
I think I'm less concerned with how he looks and how his voice sounds than I am with whether or not he convincingly pulls off the swagger. I think that's one of the defining elements of Han Solo as a character, is just the swagger and the attitude that Harrison Ford brought to the role. And I feel like that's something you can either live up to or you can completely miss the mark on, and that'll, for me at least, make or break whether or not the character works.
Okay, well, I've splayed my contempt for the... Oh my gosh, Emilia Clarke is in this?
Huh, did not see that coming.
Yeah, huh, okay. yeah, I'm just looking it up now, which, again, is a sign of my general disinterest. I don't look up anything, like you, about movies that I know I want to see. But if I'm not sure I want to see it, then I'll investigate a little bit, because, you know, I may find out something that... piques my interest. Anyway, but, you know, I've said my piece, but there are a number of things that you're looking forward to as well. And what are they?
So I'll start off by saying I actually do agree with you that I think Star Wars fandom has put itself into a bad place over the last 20 or 30 years, however long it's been since Star Wars originally came out. At some point, Star Wars fandom became obsessed with theories and hidden knowledge and conspiracies and linking everything to everything else and concocting elaborate backstories of going back 500 or 1,000 years into the Star Wars universe and how everything, one thing follows another and inevitably leads to this. And this character is the secret son or daughter. And part of it is George Lucas's fault, of course, because we started out with a very simple set of characters in Luke and Leia and Han and Obi-Wan. And then we find out in the second movie that, oh, heavens, Darth Vader is Luke's father. And then, to make it worse, we find out in Empire Strikes Back that, oh, and Leia is Luke's sister, and they're all tied together. And that started this whole thing with the prequels of everybody wanting everybody to tie together, and then these elaborate theories after The Force Awakens came out as to who Rey was, and was she a secret Skywalker, was she a secret Solo, was she a secret Kenobi, you know, is she Obi-Wan's granddaughter? And I think Star Wars fandom has gotten obsessed with all of this stuff having to tie together. And that's a huge part of the anger towards The Last Jedi, is the fact that Rian Johnson didn't care about any of that. And I think we talked about it on the episode, rightfully so, didn't care about any of that. And I think if Star Wars is going to survive as a thing, fans have got to get over tying everything to everything else. So that being said, as a really, really long lead-in to why I'm looking forward to Solo. Solo seems like a character with... Han seems like a character with a rather uncomplicated backstory. He's a rogue. He's a pirate. He's a smuggler. He's a pilot. He had adventures. and that's it. And if it stays that way, and I dearly hope it stays that way, I feel like he's a character that had entertaining adventures in his past that we can see on screen and be entertained with. And sure, he ties into the Star Wars story that we know and love because he was a central character in it, but we don't need to have all of this conspiracy theory garbage going along with him. It, again, at least I hope not.
You make an excellent point. In theory, Solo could be a James Bond-like sub-franchise, in that you could just pick up Han Solo in the middle of his latest adventure, or Indiana Jones, if you like, another Harrison Ford franchise, and then leave him still broke and only one step ahead of the law until the next episode, if you will. Yeah, that's true. In theory, you could just divorce him from most of the goings-on that make up the Uber story.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hoping for. I have read a few of the Expanded Universe novels, not that many because most of them were honestly dreadful. But my understanding of Han's backstory is that he was at one point a pilot in the Imperial Academy, if nothing else, and either flunked out of the academy, got kicked out of the academy, or deserted from the Imperial Navy at some point after graduation. I'm not clear on which, and honestly, I don't care. Just that somehow he started out with the Imperials and then got on their bad side. Chewbacca is his sidekick, companion, loyal partner, and somewhere in the backstory, something happened with Han and Chewie to where Chewbacca owes Han a life debt, and that's why he sticks with Han through thick and thin. And then a huge part of the story is that, you know, of course, the Millennium Falcon is Han Solo's ship, but it wasn't originally his ship. He may not have even been the one that hot-rodded it. It was originally Lando Calrissian's ship, and Han won it off of him in a game of chance. An event for which Lando has never fully forgiven him, or definitely least forgotten. And so when I'm looking at a Solo movie that's showing his backstory, I think I'm wanting to see at least two of those three things to make the movie entertaining for me. And those are all things that fall under just fun adventure. What did Han do that caused the break with the Imperials, or with the Empire, or what happened? What kind of adventure did he and Chewie have together? Or what were they each doing separately that their paths intersected? And Han said Han had such a huge effect on Chewie that Chewie felt like he owed him a life debt. Okay, and honestly, if we don't see the whole transfer of the Millennium Falcon from Lando to Han, I'm going to be disappointed. I suppose out of the three, that's the part I want to see the most. Just because it seems like a fun scene or sequence of scenes. But again, this is all uncomplicated stuff that if the movie can just keep it uncomplicated and fun, I will enjoy my time at the theater and will consider the movie to have been a success.
I can add one outstanding question to this list of yours. How Han got indebted to Jabba. Oh no, I guess that they explained that in the first movie, don't they? They say that he saw some Imperials and got spooked.
Yeah, and dumped his cargo, and then, of course, owes Jabba for the entire cargo, which one can assume as a smuggler isn't a small amount of money.
Well, Han's pretty young in this film anyway, so it's entirely possible he meets Jabba 10 years after this film, or 20.
Right, that seems like the kind of crime boss that you would work your way up towards working for.
At the same time, they may not be able to resist, you know, connecting everything. We'll see.
Yeah, let's hope they don't go for the temptation to throw in everything plus the kitchen sink. I would like to see some measure of restraint from the filmmakers.
Okay, well, I'm in. Let's see what we got.
Yeah, and we'll be back in about 2 weeks to let you know what we thought of the film.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well @AdamVolle. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.